to just get this done, like the triumph of human experience. I mean, it's a real thing. That is so, so good. And frankly, that's what gives me hope, not only in the sport of ultra running, but in the world. Like when that happens, when you got an hour left to get from here to there, you're going to figure out a way to do it. And you know what? If you end up not doing it, you're going to figure out a way to maybe do it next year or in some other race. That's just beautiful.
We had a great discussion and we hope that you enjoy it. Coming up soon, it is the simple seven of finishing a long run. And that long run can be defined at whatever distance it is for you.
It's the recipe for success to avoid a DNF by applying these simple seven rules.
Those are coming up just as soon as we talk to you about a couple of our partners. Hey, Don, do you know what stinks?
What's that?
My shoes. I get home and I take my shoes off and they stink.
But you know what's got, you know what doesn't have to stink? That's your armpits. And that's because we recommend that you use, like we do, Native deodorant because it works, smells great, and it's effective.
They have a lot of different products and they have some new stuff. This fall, they have their Coffee House collection, which includes scents that are strong, spicy, soothing, and sweet. Their limited edition fragrances are Oat Milk Latte, the Matcha and Sweet Cream, the Earl Grey and Mulberry. That one intrigues me. I think I need to try that one. The Cherry and Vanilla Macaroon. All these scents are available in their classic deodorant, their scents of deodorant, and their body washes.
Now, these things sound good enough to eat, but you don't. You put it underneath your arm so you don't stink too.
Go to nativedeo.com/trail. That's nativedeo.com/trail, and you can get 20% off your first order.
And ExoSkin can be one of the solutions to watching those many variables on the run. How your foot fits and rides inside of your shoe.
Blisters can pull you over to the side of the trail, and it can actually cause DNFs. Blisters are caused when there's friction and heat. Friction on the bottom of your foot between the sock and the foot and between the foot and the shoe. So you want to make sure you have good footwear, but more importantly, you want to have a sock that fits well so there is no movement or no friction there. And ExoSkin has the best socks that I've found to prevent that friction.
Gear for men and women, they start with ExoSkin underwear, compression bottoms, leg and arm sleeves, and headwear.
You can get 15% off by going to exoskin.us and use the code TRN. That's exoskin.us. Use the code TRN. Thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Scott War.
I'm Andy Jones Wilkins.
And I'm Don Freeman. And Scott, how come every time we start lately, you start off by laughing like something's been going on before the show?
Because there's something going on before the show.
Well, today's show Andy just came up with the title, The Simple Seven.
Ooh.
And we really think it's important to talk about these Simple Seven. We're going to lay out the rules for finishing a run, a long run, whatever distance it is for you, whether it's a 10-mile or 100-mile or beyond. These rules apply. And do the math. You might have to carve them up a little bit, turn a dial here and there to make it work for your event. But this applies to anybody, any distance, any speed. Wouldn't you say, AJW?
I would, and I think this it's a wonderful list. And one of the things that scares me about this podcast, and Scott and I talked about this offline before, is that this might be the first podcast in the history of podcasts that Don prepared for. So listeners out there, you may be in for something, but absolutely, I think the notion of preparing for a run and doing something with purpose and having a result that you can be proud of is what this is all about tonight.
Well, we put together some simple rules here, a recipe not to DNF. I mean, if you apply these seven principles as you're out there on the trail and you monitor yourself and you apply these rules, there's a good shot that you'll end up at the finish line with your bib on. And that's really what this is about. And so, yes, I did put some rules together and I sent them around and I watched for them to morph and change and edit because I put that instruction on there, make these better, guys. and they pretty much left him untouched. Now, I don't know if it's because these guys thought they were good, or they just don't read my emails. So I think it's probably a time that we bring that up now and let the people hear. Do you read my emails, guys?
Do you send emails?
All right. So this is a working list. And I think the very first thing I'm just going to come out and say is, yes, and if there's anybody that's listening to this with a friend that's not a trail runner, you might want to turn it down or hit skip ahead a little bit. But one of the things that we call endurance runs, we're not always running, right? I mean, that's one of the things that doesn't always apply. We're not always moving ahead in a running pace like you think of a 5K or even a marathon. So here's my working list. I'm going to start with the one. And part of the rules here of our simple rules for the three of us is we got to come up with a story to support the rule. Now, we didn't collaborate. We're not even sure what the stories are, but I know with AJW and Scott, they can come up with a story for about anything. So my first rule, and then you guys pick up on the rest, and we'll do a round robin here, is don't run a single hill. And the definition of hill really depends on your fitness level and the speed that you run and where you are in the race. And sometimes those change. But simple rule is don't run hills. You don't need to. And you can still finish with a decent time as long as you don't rob from your reserves. Staying fresh is really important. So my first simple rule, if it's a hill, don't run it and start early. I mean, that's at mile one, because you should treat mile one like mile finish mile. You should just have your body working efficiently, working at a constant work level, heart rate level from the start to the finish. So that's my simple rule number one. Guys, any comments on that?
I have a story.
Oh, good.
I moved to the San Francisco Bay Area in 2001, and I signed up for the Dick Collins 50-mile fire, what's now called the Fire Trails 50. Dick Collins, a legendary Bay Area ultra runner. And the Dick Collins Fire Trails 50 took place every October, still takes place every October. Beautiful 50K course in the hills above Oakland and Berkeley and so forth. And I was eager. I was in my early 30s. I was coming into the ultra scene and after living for 5 years in Arizona, and I was going up the first climb before we're even on the trail. It's still on the bike trail. And I was running the whole thing. And Charles Savage, who is now 70 plus years old and 20-time Western States finisher and a member of the Western States board, turned to whoever was next to him and said, "Who is that guy running all this stuff?" And I kind of looked back, being the cocky young jerk that I was, and you know what? Charles Savage passed me on the downhill before the turnaround, came around back, kind of smiled and waved, ended up finishing probably half an hour ahead of me. And I learned my lesson. You know, walk those hills.
That's a great story. I'm gonna follow up with a similar type of story that is cemented in my brain that I cannot get rid of it. It's like it just happened before this podcast. We were at Angeles Crest 100, and it starts with a pretty good climb. And I'm getting along in this chain of people, and this guy is going a little bit slow. That's out in front. I think we've got to get going. We've got a race here. And he got around this guy that I was right behind, and he worked his way around this guy up over the edge, and off he went. And so then he's going, I think I should do the same thing because, you know, heck, I should. And, you know, you're only a few miles in. You've got a lot of power and energy and enthusiasm. And the guy that got past said, "Boy, is he going to regret that later." I did not say on your left after that. I said, "Ooh." And I was so glad as I'm running that race, that thing went through my mind so many times. Like, I had no business trying to get around that guy. That was a really poor move. And I'm glad the guy did it in front of me, because it would have been me that he said that about. And so that was a great lesson to learn.
You know, I have a question for both of you. You know, Western States starts at Olympic Village, and the first, what is it, 1.7 miles? How far is it to the escarpment?
It's 4 miles.
Okay. See, one of the other rules we'll get to it here in a minute is about math.
and knowing your course.
So it's 4 miles to the escarpment, and it's almost all uphill, but it's at the beginning of this race and everybody's energy is super high. The adrenaline is going. They start the race with a shotgun, and there's a lot of bells and whistles and cheering, and it's really, really hard not to run out of the starting gate. And, you know, even me, who there shouldn't be any reason I should be running a hill at all, got caught up in that. And luckily, I had some smarter people around me that were boxing me in a little bit that said, no, we're going to walk this thing. We're going to walk 4 miles before we even start running. And so my question to you guys is at the beginning of a race, you mentioned, Don, Angela's Crest starts with an uphill. Andy, I'm sure you started many races that start with an uphill. How do you force yourself or remind yourself not to run that first incline?
One of my strategies is, you know, just show up in such poor shape that you really don't have a choice. There's no running that thing. So, you know, and I've shown up in poor shape many, many times, and you've got to protect yourself. You've got to pretend like what you're working with is fragile, and fitness and your ability to move that many miles is fragile. And if you break it early, you're going to be broken later. So I just tell myself, let's just move efficiently. If I'm moving at the same workload that I'd be happy with on the last mile that I'm working on the first mile, that's how I think about it. I do a reflection to the end. And I said, would I be happy moving this fast at the end? And if the answer is yes, then I just stay right there. And I know at the end of the race, whatever that long race is, if I'm not going to run a hill because I can't. I'm beat up. So I save myself and I think to the final miles and bring them back to the beginning. That's my theory.
I would say that, you know, having climbed that hill 10 times in races, you have to block out everybody else. And it's hard. There's hype, there's excitement, everybody's tapered, there's all these fancy, fast people, there's people with their phones and everything else. You have to block it out. And I think a funny story about that is, I can't remember what year it was. It might have been 2007 or 9, where Hal Kerner, it was when it was 2009, Scott Jurek was coming back to run the race. And for whatever reason, those guys took a wrong turn, literally like 400 meters into the race. And for a brief second, Craig Thornley, who's now the race director, was winning the race because he knew the course and he was walking. So you need to just pay attention to where you are. And it's not just for the first 4 miles or the first climb, but it's for as long as you can. Like, as long as you're doing what you set out to do, you have to be deliberate about what you set out to do when you start. But as long as you're being deliberate about what you set out to do, you really have to ignore the other people.
And that's really the key to the simple seven, is being deliberate about each of these 7 points and run your own race.
Hey, now, AJW, this is great advice for Scott and I, but what if you're chasing the podium like you did those so many years, and you've got competition and they are all around you and there's testosterone and egos and everything in the mix and it's stirred up right there in the beginning? How do you pull off keeping that pace back and keeping within yourself?
Well, you know that even when you get to the top of the escarpment, there's 96 miles left, most of which is downhill. Right. And you have your strengths. You've done your homework, you've done your training, and you have to trust that. I think the part of the sport that is so hard is for people to trust what they've done, who they are, and what their strengths are and what their weaknesses are. For me, for example, I knew I was never going to pass anybody on an uphill, but I was very likely to pass quite a few people on the downhills. And I just had to wait for those downhills. And if I got to the last downhill and I hadn't passed, I pretty much knew at the end of the last downhill that I was in the place that I was going to be when I finished. And whether that's a place, whether that's a time, whether that's a, I think mentally part of the walking the uphills is you get to a point where you need to know whether you're a front runner or a person chasing the cutoffs, that you are going to finish this race. You know, I had a conversation with a guy recently who had ran the Kodiak 100, which is a wonderful little small boutique 100 down at Big Bear Lake in Southern California. And he got to mile 75. It's the top of Sugarloaf Pass. And he got there in about 28 hours. The cutoff for the race is 30. He got there in 24 hours. And the cutoff for the race is 36. And he knew, I can run 25 miles in 12 hours. So for him, the race was over. Not over literally, but he knew he was going to finish when he got to mile 75 in 24 hours. And the rest, he said, was like a big old victory lap. And this was his first 100 miler. So that's where the wisdom of walk every uphill comes in and does so much down the trail.
And there's some science and physiology to this too. I think we've talked about on other podcasts that if you intentionally walk, and I don't want to get ahead of ourselves here, but if you're intentionally walking those uphills, your legs are going to be fresher so that if it's flat or downhill, when you get to the top, you're going to be able to perform much, much better than if you were to run that hill and be completely exhausted when you get there and have to recover and go slower when you reach the top. And maybe you're not running as fast because you're so tired. It's better to power hike the hill and then hit it when you get to the top.
Agreed. Who's taking number two, unless there's more stories to unravel there? But if we don't move ahead, we're going to have a 7-part series here. So
I've got number two, and number two is run all the downs. So you've got walk all the ups and run all the downs. Make gravity your friend. Now, when you decide to do this, you need to think about, well, have I run enough downs in training? Am I running the downs appropriately enough that I'm not trashing my quads or overtaxing myself, or, you know, but in many ultras, whether it's a 50K, a 50 miler, a 100 miler or beyond, there are plentiful downhills where you can put some time in the bank. You know, if your assignment is to run 17-minute miles and the first 4-minute climb, you've done 24-minute miles, and all of a sudden you're like, oh, crap, I'm like 24 minutes behind what I'm supposed to be. A nice little gravel road downhill for 4 miles is all of a sudden going to make that back up. And you can do it with little effort. You can take in calories along the way. You can think about how your body's feeling. You can really take advantage of those downhills in a way that doesn't tax your body, that doesn't increase your heart rate, and is as much a part of the Simple Seven. I mean, it's so great that these are the first two. Walk the ups, run the downs.
And I'm trying to remember who it was that coined the phrase, run like the water flows.
Scott Jurek.
I was going to say that, but I'm glad that you
that was definitely that. Scott, and it was a great quote.
And AJW, you are a downhill runner. Did you naturally, was that something that came naturally, or did you just learn how to be a good downhill runner? What are some keys?
For me, I just developed it. It just so happened that I ended up running with a few mentors who had bodies like mine, you know, 6 feet tall, longish legs, Tim Tweetmeyer, Tom Nielsen, to name two. And I realized, you know, that's where you make up time. You just can stride 3 inches longer than everybody else on every stride going downhill. And it was kind of something that I learned from experience in a 50K relatively young age. I would catch up to Scott Jurek and Ian Torrance and people who were, you know, the class of the sport in the mid late 90s. And I realized, oh, I can hang with these guys on the downhills. So I must be good at them. And I think that if you can learn something like that, and even now as a mid to back of the packer, I will have these experiences where a bunch of people will pass me on the uphills because I can only go so fast, and I'll pass them back on the downhills. And so you need to learn that about yourself and understand it, but also play to your strengths. And so ultimately the races I was most successful with, obviously, were the ones that had a net downhill, right? They started higher than they finished because you're just going to have a better chance of doing well in something like that.
And I think there's a fine line too. If you're not running the downhill, sometimes you can fall into the trap of braking too much. So every stride you're braking and you're trashing your quads. And so it is good to practice running downhills and letting gravity take you down rather than fighting gravity by pushing back on it. I want to go back to one of the funnest times I have ever had running downhills are with the Hoka 10-9 shoe, which was made for downhill running. If you can get yourself, I don't know if they still make it, I think it would be a great training tool because it gives you the confidence to run downhill and be safe, and then go back to your whatever shoe that is your preference. But get into the mind frame that I'm going to let gravity help me down the hill and keep your feet moving. It's better to do short, choppy steps than big, long leaps where your foot is out in front of you when you land and causing it to break. That's my tip.
Yeah, well, and that reminds me, and I have to give credit where it's due, and that's Julie Fingar used to tell me, Don, it's just a dance. Running downhill is a dance. Pick your spot, and watch and select where your foot's going to land and just enjoy it. And a downhill is a dance.
And on to number three of the Simple Seven, start early with a purposeful walk-run rhythm. You want to do this, you want to keep your body fresh. Every time you shift from a run, make sure that the walk is a purposeful walk. And shifting from the run to the walk, if you can get into a rhythm early in the race, that's going to pay dividends down the road. I will tell you the story that I have. When I first started running, I couldn't run a mile without walking. So it was a default that I couldn't run a mile without doing some walking. But then I read, and I can't remember the great marathoner that came up with the walk-run philosophy. Andy, you probably know.
Galloway?
Jeff Galloway. Jeff.
2 points for Don so far.
Yep.
I've got two.
If you're keeping track.
I am.
Jeff Galloway, I remember reading a book by him, and he talked about the run-walk method. And it's different for everybody, but he was basically saying, run for a mile, walk for a minute. Run for a mile, walk for a minute. And you can change those up to whatever frequency and ratios you want. And I remember the first time I decided I was going to go out and try to run 10 miles, and I was able to do it with an intentional run a mile, walk for a minute, run a mile, walk for a minute. And at the end of the 10 miles, when I got back to my house, I was surprised. I felt I can keep going. So it's really good. It changes the muscles up that you're using when you do that short little, and you think, you know, if I walk for a minute, when you look at the overall time, it doesn't really slow you down a whole lot.
There's a whole paragraph there, and I hope that the part that says, and it was in quotes, walk with a purpose, because that's so important. When you get out there many miles, you get a little bit fatigued, a little bit lackadaisical, and all of a sudden you start to feel defeated because you're walking, and then it's a stroll, and it's dangerous, and it's slow. But if you say, I'm going to walk, but I'm going to walk with purpose, you can really make some time up and some ground up. It isn't a loss. It's a strategy. But you have to remind yourself that I need to walk with purpose and get some real estate underneath me while I'm walking this piece, and then start running again. And wow, it's very, very effective. You've taken a bio break, your partner has continued walking, and you think, that guy ran because there's no way he's that far ahead of me. but it's just walking smartly, and it's a efficient way to travel. And that's what humans have done it for eons of time.
I want to just put a little caveat in here. You need to make sure that if it's a training run and you're running with someone, they need to know that you're going to be doing this. And if you're starting a race and you hook up with somebody at the start, you need to let them know that, hey, this is my strategy. I'm going to walk. And I did that with Rick Nelson when we ran AR50. From the very beginning, we said, this is our plan. After a mile, we're going to walk for a minute. And we started that. We almost didn't, after the first mile, we thought, we're feeling kind of fresh. We still have the adrenaline going. And Rick looked at me and said, no, we're walking for a minute. And we did that the entire 50 miles. So you need to let your partner know.
I think one of the mistakes people make in their mind, not so much in their body, is that walking is taking a rest. And it's really not. I mean, walking, there are times where you can actually be more efficient walking than running. I remember, again, going back to my early days as an ultra runner, going out and doing a lot of training on the Angeles Crest course with some of those old timers from Southern California. And they had actually done sort of field tests. And on one of the signature climbs of the Angeles Crest course, which is Mount Baden-Powell, which is a 3,000-foot climb over about 3.8 miles. And they had trained on it enough that they were like, and there's like 40-something switchbacks. They had walked every step and they had run-walked it. And they had tried to run the whole thing. And they realized the advantage of running was so minimal that you might as well just walk the whole thing. And we're talking about front pack people, like people doing Angeles Crest in under 20 hours. And that was so illuminating to me because it said what you guys are talking about. Like you can save energy, you can use different muscles, and you can locomote down the trail in a way that's going to come back in spades when you have to drag yourself up that climb at mile 87 and get up there any way you possibly can.
You know, this is a perfect time to submit this in, part story, part just information to carry with you. Is Dana Gard taught me, somebody taught Dana, and somebody before that person taught that person. It's been passed on for eons, no doubt. I heard it as 25-25. Scott's heard it as 40-40, and it can end up being any number you want, but it's count your steps on your right foot 25 times on your right foot, and then count both steps when you're walking, and just keep that rhythm. And it's just amazing how that counting process takes away things that are happening around you, maybe some pain that you have, maybe some of the fact that you're tired. You just get into this counting rhythm. And next thing you know, you're at the top of the hill, 25, 25. You can stretch it longer, shorten it up, whatever you need at the time, commit to it and just get into the rhythm and propel yourself, locomote, like you said, AJW, up that hill. And I love the 25, 25 or 40, 40 or however you want to count.
And I was going to say, if you don't believe us and you're skeptical, the next time you go out with one of your pals, pick a moderate hill and tell that person just to keep a steady running pace. And then you do this 25-25 or 40-40. And I can't tell you, I specifically remember a time when Don and I were running with someone and we're going up Stagecoach, Don, which is a hill that we are very used to. And this person just kept a steady running pace. And we did the 40-40 or whatever we did. And we actually beat him to the top of the hill, because we were running faster when we were running, and the walk with purpose section was walking with purpose, which really wasn't slowing us down a whole lot, but it gave our legs a little bit of rest. It gave us a chance to maybe lower our heart rate so that when we started the running cycle, we were in a better position to do that.
Yeah. Good stuff.
Hey, we're going to take a quick break from our simple seven solutions to running and being successful on a long run.
And if you want to stand out in a good way and look fashionable too, then pull on a set of John G. gear.
And John G., we teased this last week. where we said they're coming out with this new line that's based on the American Southwest. Well, they are. And this week, they just released one of our favorites, the Trail Runner Pack Jacket.
It's fashionable, fits well, and it just looks good.
The latest version is 3 times more waterproof and 3 times more breathable, so you don't get swampy. That's the worst part of a rain jacket, is you put it on and yeah, it keeps the water out, but sometimes it keeps the sweat in. This one has ventilation all the way around, makes it so that you can breathe and stay dry.
Otherwise, you might as well just run around in a hefty bag. They'll keep the water out.
TRN listeners get 15% off all of the Rain Runner we just talked about and all their other gear with the code TRN15. Go to johng.com and use the code TRN15.
And now back to the Simple 7 discussion with AJW.
Okay, you're next, Don.
I'm up again.
Simple 7, number 4 of Simple 7.
Simple 7, the Strategic 7. There's a lot of S's we could put together here. And this is number 4, and it's manage your aid stations and show up with a plan. Don't walk in there going, oh, an aid station. You know what you need, know what you want to do, and then allow the volunteers that are there, because that's what they want to do. You think back to when you're volunteering, you want to be helpful. Let them take care of hydration. Go in there and give them your order. That's not being too demanding. Say, hey, fill this up, you know, with half ice, half electrolyte drink, whatever your flavor is, and then go straight to either fixing your gear or medical. If you need some lube, if you need something special that might be laying around, go to that. And then the third thing, after you pick up your filled fluids, take all your food, put it in your hand, carry as much as you want, and then just walk out of the aid station, because it's really about moving. And if you're standing around, you're losing that ground that you could be covering. So get out there and eat while you walk purposefully, and really get supercharged through your aid station. And then don't forget to get rid of your trash, and then then move on. AJW, you have a follow-up.
I love this one, Don. I think this might be my favorite of the four, because, or the seven, it's the fourth, but because of the fact that it's, the aid stations represent these little islands, these little oases, right? Mm-hmm. And hopefully, if you've done your homework in your race, you know when they're coming, or as you're running along the trail, you start to hear the aid station. The piece of advice I would add to that is, once that happens, so you know, maybe you've run the race before and you know, when I get to this switch back, the aid station's going to be 3 minutes away, or maybe you hear the music playing or whatever. At that point, use some mental energy and say, okay, I'm going to have to fill my bladder. I'm going to have to get some solid food. I know I have a drop bag here, so I'm going to change my socks. I'm going to do, so rehearse what you're going to do there. So you're going to do that stuff and get out of there, because you're going to be better walking, eating the quesadilla, than standing there eating the quesadilla. But you're also going to be like switching your mindset into aid station mode before you get. I like to think of it as like in NASCAR, the cars have to slow down as they go into the pit stop. It's kind of like that. You know, the pit stop's coming. So you have to collect yourself and be like, okay, I need this. Now, if it's late enough in a race and you have a pacer, the pacer can ask you, okay, what do you want here? You got to fill your bottles. You want to have some Coke. Your stomach's a little unsettled. You want to find out if they have melon or quesadillas or whatever. I think doing 3 to 5 minutes before you get into the aid station can make getting through the aid station all that much faster. Make the aid station experience still enjoyable and still feel like a rest, if you will. But it's about the efficiency. So it's on the front end preparation for that aid station, as well as executing in the aid station.
I want to just add something to that with a story.
I know your story, Scott. Let me put this one thing in quick, because I know exactly what story, because this is right on the heels of AJW. You're coming in to an aid station. You've got one bottle full, which you shouldn't have, because you should be putting it in as you're moving. But don't carry a full bottle into an aid station. Run with it, either put it in your belly and start the process of fluid getting in again, or throw it out. There is no sense carrying a full bottle. I'd prefer to get it in the belly so it starts hydrating you. You needed it. You carried it 7 miles. You've earned it. Drink it. But otherwise, get rid of it. Get new fresh stuff and then run with an empty bottle if you're not going to drink it. But don't show up with a full bottle. Be smart. Go ahead, Scott. Let's hear your
story. You're going to be wrong because I know which story you think I'm going to say, but I'm not going to say that one. I want to go to a story where I actually was running the Dick Collins Fire Trails. And here is my point. Well, here's my story, and then I'll make my point. You could have a drop bag at the turnaround point at mile 25. And by the time I got to mile 25, where my drop bag is, I was not having a good day. I was frustrated. It was a hard day. It was a miserable, miserable day, Don. And the only thing I kept thinking is, oh, I have this my drop bag at mile 25, and I have some of my own nutrition there, and I can do this and do that, some stuff that I really needed. Well, I pulled in to that aid station, no drop bag. I searched everywhere I could, no drop bag. And because I wasn't prepared for that I was really banking on my drop bag being where it was supposed to be, it just tanked me. And I had to sit, I didn't have to, but I sat down and I actually contemplated whether I was going to finish the race. So to my point, the preparation point, Andy, you may be going into an aid station and having the plan. I love the analogy of NASCAR where you need to prepare for that 3 to 5 minutes out. But part of that preparation, I would say, is if you're counting on cold Coca-Cola, it may not be there. So make a plan, but don't be afraid for that plan to fall apart and have some contingencies in there. Was that the story you thought it was, Don?
No, but I'm going to challenge you to tell the story that you think I was going to tell because you know what it is.
Yeah, this is the story that Don assumed I was going to be telling, and it was a great
lesson. It's a better story, that's why.
Oh, I don't know if it's better. Just for that, I'm going to tell it poorly. No, this was when I was running Western States and Don was pacing me. Is this what you're talking about?
Yep. Go ahead.
Yeah. And Don was such a good pacer. I don't think there's a better pacer on the planet.
End of story. End of story.
Scene.
Wait, now we have the new TRN intro.
He should be on the podium of pacers. Anyway, this is one thing that he taught me, and it was super valuable. And he mentioned at the very beginning, once you're in the aid station, grab food and leave the aid station. Because you don't need to be standing static in an aid station eating. You can eat while you walk. And the tip that Don taught me was I could walk as long as I was eating. And so what I would do, my strategy at the aid station was get as much food as I can carry and eat it. But it was a great strategy because Don knew I needed calories. And so it was a good strategy all the way around. So grab handfuls of food and then pound it and go ahead, give yourself permission to walk while you're eating. And once it's down, then take off.
That was a story, Scott. You told it well.
Okay.
All right, AGW, any stories you have, aid station lore that you can share with us, or should we move on?
Well, I guess I want to add, Scott brought me to you're expecting the drop bag and it's not there. Mm-hmm. And so it's a little bit of the expect the unexpected. There was a year, 2006 at Western States where it was unexpected, happened all the time. It happened sort of spontaneously where I, you know, when you're at mile 43, last chance, you're just about ready to go down into Deadwood Canyon, and it's the, you know, steepest climb going up to Devil's Thumb afterwards. And I, like Western States, you just give them your bottles and they do their thing and you can eat off the aid stations and whatever else. But what happened was the aid station volunteer, I don't know who it was, but my bottle broke. I don't want to blame him, but the top broke off and I freaked out because here I am going into Deadwood Canyon and all of a sudden, and he kind of came up to me. He's like, well, sorry, you know, this little top part came off. And, And by top part, he meant like the spout on my bottle. So I couldn't, like, it was just going to like, you know, splash all over the place. And so it was like panic mode. And so then, you know, I was like, okay, well, just you, this bottle's broken. We'll throw it away. And I guess I'll just go through the canyon with this one bottle. And that was a real bummer. And then I kind of went along in a little while and I was talking to couple of the runners I was with, and I was like, I hope the spring at the bottom has water in it and all that. But you do need to, in addition to manage the aid stations and be prepared for things that might not be there that you hope are there, to just expect the unexpected. I think that would be an addendum to one of the simple rules, is that, and you can't plan for anything, but if you just assume something bad is going to happen, don't know that it's going to happen, and don't get all mentally down into some kind of black hole just because it happened. Because then I was able, the spring had water in it. I got back up to Devil's Thumb. I was okay with one bottle. And then, you know, 8 miles later, I saw my crew and I said, yeah, my bottle broke back at mile 43, and we were all fresh and new and went off again. So I think it's important to realize that you can only do so much. And when you wrote in here, it kind of triggered me because you said, let a volunteer fill your hydration. And I still have that memory 15 years later of like, you know what? I'll just fill my own bottle.
You know, I actually have heard that story before from you, Andy. And that's exactly where my thought went when Don wrote that down. Let the aid station worker fill your water bottle. I thought, I bet you Andy doesn't.
I didn't ever since then. I would screw him off before I got in there, and I'd be like, oh no, I'll just fill my bottle here. Don't worry about it.
Andy, I think you have number five.
Okay. I really love this one too. And we've talked about this a lot on the podcast. Monitor anything that feels slightly off. Calories, hydration, electrolytes, salt on your face, salt on your shirt, color of your urine, cramping, stomach, apply lube to anything hot, and listen to negative mental chatter. Negative chatter is your body's way of telling you that you need to change something. If you push through the early warning sign, catastrophe is around the corner. So there's really two parts to this, if I could start. First is monitor anything that feels slightly off. Second is negative chatter. Anything that feels slightly off. I think the biggest issue here often comes with feet. Someone feels like, oh, I have a rock in my shoe, or, oh, my sock is folded over, or, you know, and it's like mile 8 and it's like, oh no, I don't need to worry about it. It'll be okay. Or, you know, and then it gets a little bit later and it's like what Don has pointed out here with salt on face, salt on shirt. This is something the late great Dr. Bob Lind talked about at Western States for so often, just monitoring your sodium. And then, of course, when it gets deeper into it, the color of your urine, cramping, when your stomach goes south, if you're chafing, if you haven't gotten lube to your chafing parts too early. I mean, you have, if you correct a mistake early, and even if you take 5 minutes to take off your shoe and re-lube your feet, take 8 minutes to, you know, oh my God, I got salt all over my face, so I'm going to have to take more salt. You're going to make it up in droves, and you just ignore it and be like, oh, but I'm running with those guys. It's fine. I feel good. I'm just going to keep going.
AGW, if I can sneak in before your negative chatter and throw just to support your story, on the long runs, and especially with the 200 runs, I carried a squirrel's nut butter, a small one, in my pack. Because when do you apply something that's getting hot? When it starts to get hot, not when you get to the aid station. You know, and we've all done it, we've run with a chafe in between the thighs. How hard is that? How miserable does that make every mile? A lot. And it doesn't take much to carry one of those little squirrel nut butters. So I have it with me, and it's right there.
So I'm going to jump right back in that on and say, when I had my quite possibly the worst foot experience I've ever had in 2009, I did the foot equivalent of that, where I created, it probably weighed, I don't know, 6 ounces, but my own little foot kit that I could, and it had the special, really expensive tape, and it had the stuff that the tincture of benzoin that makes, and I could even put it in my pocket. It was it was my foot kit, because if you know that you might have a tendency for something to happen, chafing, blisters, you know, ginger chews or something people do if they know they have, like, you better have it with you, because you can't just assume that when you have a problem, an aid station is going to appear, right? Rather, you need to assume that if a problem happens, I'm going to be ready for it. And I think your squirrel's nut butter and the foot kit is a great example. So I really actually think you've created, this is two rules within a rule, Don, just to, not to be critical. And I know we want it, but the monitoring and then the negative, monitoring, failure to monitor leads to negative chatter, right? So if I could just finish this point, when you get to the point where you're talking negatively about the experience, it's almost too late, right? It's almost, or it means it's time for a total reset and a reboot. And, you know, I'm not going to get the silver buckle, or I'm not going to get the time I thought I was going to do, or I'm, you know, but when the negative chatter creeps in, it's likely because of one of these, you know, monitoring things that's gone off. And the point you make at the end is, if you try to push through those things, the little crease in your sock, the chafing in between your legs, the problem, you might be like, oh, my quad's a little tight. It's only going to get worse, and it's going to get exponentially worse if you try to push through it.
You know, we've spoken in the past. We were lucky enough, not name dropping, but we had Tim Noakes on the show early on. And he talked about hydration being, you know, and we need to learn to listen to when we're thirsty and make sure we're providing hydration when we feel we need it. And it started the conversation with Scott and I had afterwards on the trail, saying, well, maybe we just need to learn to listen better to know when we're, it's not when you're thirsty. There's several clues that come up before you can't spit, right? I mean, there's things that happen. And before it's too late. So we have to learn to listen to all of these things that you're talking about monitoring, listen to them, and listen for the slight clues that just drop in. And that's when you have to act on it. And that's why you have your foot kit in your pocket, because there's a flat rock coming up, because this needs attention now. You don't endure it. A smart runner recognizes early trouble. And when we spoke with Ann Trason, now there's a couple of names to drop, Tim Noakes and Ann Trason, all in the same little piece here. And she said the best ultra runners are the greatest problem solvers. But what she didn't tell us, she figured we probably already knew, but those problem solvers recognize problems early, and they've learned how to recognize the small clues. And that's what makes a veteran an experienced runner, because they can see things that others can't, because they haven't learned the hard way. We've got to learn these things. We can read books and listen to podcasts and talk to smart people, but you have to experience what something feels like for yourself, the experiment of one.
Hey, and real quick, Don, not everybody knows who Tim Noakes is. He is a doctor. He's also an ultra runner. He's run over 70 ultra marathons, and he's a South African doctor, one of the leading endurance research physicians that there is out there. He wrote The Lore of Running. He wrote the book Waterlogged, The Serious Problem of Overhydration in Endurance Sports. He's written so many books, so he is an authority on the subject that you were talking about.
And Ann Trason, for those of you that may not know Ann Trason, I would say easily, she's probably the number one ultra runner of all time, and she has held course records. I know when I've gone into Ultra Sign Up, put in her name, there are so many ones that drop down, and the one thing that drops down is my jaw, because nobody has that many ones after her name. She's incredible.
I want to tell a story, because we like stories, right? One of the things that I suffer from is cramping, and I have figured out that through the hard knocks on the trail is I can tell when my legs are ready to start cramping. you get that little tiny twitch, and I know that that's a cramp. Well, a solution for me is I got to back off right away. I got to slow things down, maybe even walk. But many times I get too arrogant and I go, oh, that was a little twitch. I can power through. I can continue. So instead of making the adjustment early, I think that I can solve it later down the road. And it's the wrong thing to do, because once they start cramping, then you have to stop and you have to work the cramp out. And so I was just going to say that's just a brilliant point in the simple rules.
So think about the body, you know, being upstairs, you've got things that are happening. Your brain is controlling a lot of these things, and you're going too fast. You're not eating enough. You're not drinking enough. You haven't respected the hills. You haven't stayed within yourself. And so the body starts throwing things out. So I give it a little cramp. Okay. I didn't slow them down. All right. Let's turn his stomach a little bit. So you've got all these things happening. And pretty soon, if you don't start listening, it's going to start throwing bigger things and pile bigger things on and negative chatter in. And the body's going to shut you down. It's the central governor system really talking. We've talked about in the past, and we're going to try to get Joe Yuhan to come up, who wrote an amazing article in 2013 on I Run Far, your home over there where you have the tap room, AJW. And we're going to talk to him about how the brain really works as the central governor, controlling things and allowing us to stay safe while we do these very hard things.
All right, moving on. I could have told my story for the simple rule number 6, but I have another one because I have
you can do
a lot
two
of
stories.
Failures.
You can do two stories,
here,
Scott.
Here's the simple rule. Give yourself permission to back off your effort and recapture anything that isn't working or needs correcting. So the story about the muscle cramping fits right in there. Another one issue, I have a lot of issues. The another one that I deal with a lot is blisters on my feet. And I've gotten to the point where I can tell right when they starts to heat up a little bit. And it almost feels like there's a pebble in my shoe. It's not. I know that it's not. I know that it's a blister forming. So I typically, on my longer runs, I will carry some tape and have that available. And once I feel that, I stop and I take off my shoe. I take off my sock. I know what to do or how to tape it up. And the 2 minutes that you take are going to pay dividends down the road, because it's going to save you hours of suffering.
AJW.
I have a story about the pulling back, because in 2009, I was able to run my first Hard Rock 100, and I didn't know at the time that it would, you know, be my best Hard Rock 100. But I was lucky enough to get chosen in the lottery, and I ran it, and we were going in the counterclockwise direction. And if you know anything about Hard Rock, and probably most people listening to this know something about Hard Rock, there's a climb between about mile 80, 82 and 87 up Grant Swamp Pass, which is basically going up a scree field. In fact, it's the cover of this month's Ultra Running Magazine is Scotty Mills going on the final few feet of that climb. And I was in fifth place of the race. I could see it was dawning the second day. So it was like in the 23, 24 hour into the race mode. And I looked up the climb and I saw a couple of headlamps, and my competitive juices, because I knew who the people were. It was Jared Campbell and Scott Jaime, who were rivals of mine at the time. And I was like, I've just got to haul ass up that hill and I'll catch them, and then I'll get, you know, third place. And I got into the sort of foothills of that climb, and I was breathing heavily, and I looked up and I thought, oh my God, this is an insane climb. And my pacer, Mike Stevens, who himself was a kind of a mountain man, not a big ultra runner, he'd done some ultras, but he said, you know what we need to do, AJW? We need to tone this back. We just need to pull it back. Let's just walk for a little while. What sort of food do you have in your pack? Just eat the rest of the food you have in there. Those guys aren't going anywhere. Just pull back and chill out and go up the early part of this climb before the really stupid steep scree part comes. To this day, 12 years later, I still remember that. You know, now I'm much slower. I'm not in that mode anymore. But the notion, not only the running lesson, but the life lesson of sometimes you need to look at what's ahead of you, and knowing that that's ahead of you and you have to deal with that means pull back right now. Catch your breath, eat your food, take care of yourself, because that's going to come no matter what, unless you decide to turn around and stop. That's coming no matter what. So prepare yourself for what's coming. And in that case, it meant let Jared and Scott go. Let them do their thing. You do your thing. And it worked. I mean, Scott, I never caught Scott. I did catch Jared. It turned out to be a great race. It was one of my most incredibly memorable race experiences I'll have in my life. But having that, it ended up being about 30 minutes of just being like walking at probably what was a, and we didn't have GPSs back then, but like walking that was probably 2 miles an hour for a little while made all the difference in the world. When then full daylight came and I was able to do those last couple of climbs and it was all good. So this is a really wise rule that give yourself permission. I mean, the word permission is really important, to back off. Give yourself permission, because if you do it and if you take the opportunity to give yourself the permission, you're going to come out the other side better.
Yeah, I try to give credit to those that have taught a lesson. And I think the reason I can't think of this person is because so many wise people have passed it on. And it is this, and maybe it was you, AJW, who knows, or Scott. It's that there aren't too many things that can't be fixed by backing off.
Yeah.
I love that one. And I like to put myself in there, and I can remember when I learned it and when I started using it. And it was about asking myself and being honest with myself. Yes, I feel good, but can I do this pace and this work for 4 more hours or whatever it might be? No, I can't. I mean, I'm going good and I'm making up ground. I'm not headed towards the podium. So some of these rules may not apply to those that are chasing and running the edge. Now that's something that you can speak to, AJW, and you should after I make this mid-pack comment, okay? That I ask myself, can I do this for 4 hours? And I can honestly say, no, I can't keep this up for four. I'll bury myself. Well, then back off. Don't even put yourself in a position that's going to put you at risk to bury yourself. So AJW, what about the people running on the knife edge of their abilities and their ability to endure that kind of pace and work because they're chasing the podium?
Well, hopefully I think there are two kinds of people that chase the podium: people who have experience chasing the podium and people who are really going into uncharted territory. Right. And what we see with people going, the latter group, people going into uncharted territory, is they either do amazing things or they blow up completely. Right. So when you take like what Francois Dehaene did this weekend at UTMB, he knew exactly what he was doing. He knew if he executed his race the way he had planned, the way he had trained for, no one was going to beat him, and no one did. I think the same is true for Courtney DeWalter. She knew what she could do. She knew the course. She knew. I mean, those were two master classes in what it takes to be at the front knife edge. But not everybody's going to be that. You know, sometimes you're just going to have a flyer. You know, when I think of the young lady who finished second place at CCC, the 100K, that's the companion event to UTMB, Abby Hall is her name. It was a breakout race. She got second place. It was by far her most successful ultra. And she had to push from 50K on and just be like, well, we'll just see what happens. Maybe the wheels are going to fall off and maybe they're not going to. And it turns out they didn't. So I think when you're on the knife edge, you need to practice being on the knife edge. But I also know from experience, the more time you spend on the knife edge, the little bit wider that knife edge gets. It's still a knife edge, but for someone like Francois Dehaene or Courtney DeWalter, they know what they need to do because they've experienced it enough, and they know what their competitors can or cannot do. So I think that's a really charming part of the sport, and it's a really, it separates the men from the boys, if you will. Forgive my sexist language. You know, the people who are going to be in it for the long haul are those ones who figured it out. And the people who might, you know, dabble or struggle or not find their perfect distance, it might take them a little while to figure it out.
You know, I as you were talking about that, Andy, and talking about those front runners and Abby's amazing accomplishment at CCC, Steve Prefontaine's quote, mm-hmm. There's only one pace, that's suicide pace, and today is a great day to die. That probably applies to about a half a dozen runners in a race. that's probably not a good mantra to have if you're a mid packer guy, because that suicide pace is going to kill you before you finish.
And you know, it could be, and I'm just speculating, it could be a dangerous thing to have a breakout race, have all the stars align, have your fitness and your effort and your calorie, everything perfect, and you put yourself out there in uncharted waters, and then all of a sudden, you show up to try it again next time, and it's not there for you. And it can be a surprising thing. It can be a little bit deceptive. Is there any truth to that?
Oh no, I certainly do, I think there is truth to it, but I also think that there's always that opportunity around the next corner, and that's what makes this sport so great. Is that you and it doesn't just apply to the front runner people, right? It applies to anybody. I'll give you an example from the middle of the pack. You know, last. Kara Tyklinski, who probably some people listening to this podcast know, is one of the main people behind ultralive.net. She's now a new board member of the Western States 100. She ran in 2020, in the COVID year, she ran the Yeti 100 and finished in under 20 hours. She had never run a 100-miler in under 28 hours. And she bottled. It was lightning in a bottle for her that day. She passed me with 250 meters to go. I was running the race too. And she came up and she was like, Hey, AJW, this is Kara from San Francisco. We were in Virginia. Right. And at first I was shocked. And then I was like, oh my God, this is so awesome. Like, she's having a breakout race, and it can happen at any time to anybody, for any reason. And frankly, that's part of the reason this simple rule is so good. Because like on that day, Kara gave herself permission to push, right? I mean, I never talked to her about this, but I would imagine she went along conservatively enough. And then eventually was like, you know what? I'm feeling good. And I only have 10 miles left. I'm going to get this thing done. So at the same time as you want to give yourself permission to back off, eventually you want to give yourself permission to just go for it. And I think the key in this rule is the idea of giving yourself permission.
Yeah, I'm going to add to that permission to go forward and share a story with it. And it comes from Tim Tweetmeyer, who, as it's getting towards dusk and headlamps are going to come on, he increases his pace because he knows that he's going to slow down coming up because it's dark. So he's going to make hay while the day is there, where he can see well, and then it starts to get a little bit darker. He knows his body can catch up to that. And same thing, knowing what hill climbs are coming or when you can push a little bit because you can make up because you have something come ahead that will allow you to keep you in the right zone. So knowing your course is very important too.
Hey, nice farming metaphor there, Freeman. I kind of rub off on you, haven't I?
Well, that's scary because I don't even know what part of the metaphor was farmish.
Well, you didn't get it quite right. It's make hay while the sun shines.
No, make you hay said, during you, the day.
You said, well, that's the same thing, but it's not quite. But you said make hay, which is a farming term, which is has evolved throughout the years. Hey, why don't you hit our number seven here before we run out of time when our quarter runs out?
Oh, I mean, Don, I think you have to be seven.
You are.
All right. All right. Here we go with seven.
Yep.
Seven.
You don't have your list anymore,
trust
Don?
Trust your math. I mean, and stay with your plan. You've spent a lot of time thinking about this race. You've trained for it. You've put your pace together. You've looked at the profile. You've charted out your pace times, whether it's your A times or B times, your contingency plans. You know where all your people are going to be. So just stay with your plan and trust it. Don't start worrying, am I on pace? Am I not on pace? You know where you are. And if you have 30 minutes to spare somewhere and you've used 15 of them, that's okay. Don't worry about it, because worrying costs you energy. And worrying makes you take your head off the game. And then you start to listen to the worry and not to the small clues that your body is dropping you and letting you see the things that need to be attended to. So don't worry about that. Know your math, trust your math, and run your race.
We have a friend that's running his first 100-mile race this November, and you ran through some math for him to help prepare him for how fast he should be running at the beginning of a race. Do you remember that?
We have a friend that's running his first 100-mile, and he's worried about the cutoff times, as a good thing to worry about. And so going into the race, that's his strategy. I've got to get this done under the 30 hours. Well, he says, if I can run an 18-minute mile all the way through, I'm good. So if that's the goal, to finish under cutoff, then do the math. And he's going to run a 17-minute pace. And he's going to maintain a 17-minute pace, and he's going to allow himself to walk. And it may be like AJW started off the story, 24 minutes he's hiking, and he makes it up on the downhill, but it's going to average 17 and not worry about it, not end up with some panic that takes him out of the game. And if he just sticks to that plan all the way through, and he shuffles the flats and the rollers, if he runs all the downs and he hikes all the ups, and that's his recipe, he's going to make it. And he just has to keep himself on the tracks and not deviate. And he's got a race and he's got to finish. And it'll be exciting to have his first 100-mile buckle on his belt.
And the point there is it takes the worry out of it. Like you said in the introduction of this, is this point. If you have done the math, it takes the worry out of it.
This is a kind of an interesting thing I want to say right now, but one, as I've evolved as a participant in the sport, as I think everybody listening to the podcast knows, you know, I've gone from somebody who used to run in the front of the pack to being someone who runs in the middle and sometimes in the back of the pack. And back there, there's a lot of fun that happens back there, no doubt about it, hanging out at aid stations and all that, but there's also a lot of worry, and concern, and am I doing the right thing, and is my math right? If I run, are we going to make the cutoffs? And for, you know, because a lot of maybe people know me, they're like, well, AJW, are we going fast enough? Are we going to make the cutoffs, or so forth? And what having this experience now in probably 24 races, like most recently at the Bighorn 100 in Wyoming, I think the wisdom in this number seven is the worry. And if we can figure out a way, if runners can figure out a way to, because Don is absolutely right, you use up a lot of energy worrying. There's a great Native American quote, don't let the birds of worry circle above your head, right? They are like birds of worry. They're this, and they pounce down and they hit you. And if you can quiet those birds of worry, but you can also do things that help mitigate against the birds of worry. I mean, certainly if you hear the sweepers behind you, right? If you're in Western states and you hear the horses coming, you know, you're pretty close, right? You're pretty close to the cutoffs. But there's so much worry in, you know, how many minute miles do I have to run for the rest of this thing? So having the ability to take the energy that's required to worry and channel it into moving forward, channel it into, instead of stopping at this aid station, and sitting in this chair next to the fire and eating this grilled cheese. I'm going to take this Ziploc bag and shove it full of food and walk 20-minute miles for the next 3 miles. You know, like Don told you to do, Scott, right? And so if you can do that, and then 2 aid stations later, it's like, oh, I'm 2 hours ahead of cutoffs. Maybe now I can sit in the chair for 5 minutes. I think those are there's so much wisdom in the worrying causes energy or requires energy that I think we ultimately surviving these things requires energy. And if it's going in any other direction than getting down the trail, it's wasted.
I just thought of something as you were talking, Andy, about doing the math and knowing the math. A lot of us know just because we all have GPS watches now or watches we're keeping track, what our average, you know, pace is when we're running. But I think, at least in my case, not all the time. I mean, if I'm walking with a purpose, do I know what that pace per mile is? And knowing what that pace per mile is, I think can alleviate some of the worry as well. You know what your overall pace is when you go out for a training run, but that has some ups and some downs. And on a training run, you may be running some of those uphills because you have fresh legs. But knowing if I have to walk this flat section and I'm walking with purpose, what is that pace? Is it 12 minutes? Is it 15 minutes? Is it 17? Is it 20 minutes? And being able to know what that pace is, I think, is important also.
And when you think about worrying, I'm going to go back to AJW's comment, although Scott, yours was a good one. And I think it's 18 to 19 minutes. That's what I think I meant. And that's with a purpose. Casually walking can be 21 minutes. And so there's a big gap there. And that's why I was thinking walk with purpose. Now, to the worry piece, what's the one thing that happens historically to even non-runners, just people that worry? It turns the stomach. You can't have a stomach turning. You need a very efficient gastrointestinal system. You need to process. You don't need worry on top of that and start to work with different hormones and cortisol and sympathetic nervous system and all the things that happen when you worry, the fight or flight response. So it's very, very important. Another comment on your string of comments that were good, AJW, is I have never seen more fierce racing than at the end with the cutoff group. When they're fighting that, they collect together, they become tight and they become a team. And I was San Diego 100, Scotty Mills race. I was pacing someone at the end and we were all doing the math and we were thinking, okay, who's the smartest one here who's run the least amount of miles that can actually do some simple math? Okay, that was our designated mathematician. And so mathematician came up with the numbers and he said, it's going to be close. I wasn't the mathematician. And so, but I did have fresher legs as a pacer. And they said, Don, you go out in front, you find the aid station and you whistle when you get there and we'll hear it and we'll know. We have very little time to get there, but give us hope. Just go out there, get to it, spend what you have left. Even if we have to throw you away at the aid station, that's fine. We'll sacrifice you because you're not that great with us anyway. Go there and whistle. If we hear you, we'll have comfort. And so there's some fierce, fierce racing that happens at the end of a pack.
I wanted to concur with Don's point about the chasing the cutoff people converging together and being fierce. Like what I've witnessed at Western States, especially in the last decade since I've not been running it, with this golden hour and with the people, it's a once in a lifetime experience and people congealing together to just get this done, like the triumph of human experience. I mean, it's a real thing. And so if the rule is do the math beforehand and worrying requires energy, eventually, like, you're going to get to life's version of No Hands Bridge, which is mile 96.5 of the Western States 100. And you're going to look at your watch and be like, I have to get to the track in this much time. You're going to figure out a way to get there. And I think what the triumph in all this, and I love that Don said that everyone comes together and it's just like, hey, you know, let's look at the smartest person. Let's figure it out. Some pacer, you know, who went to MIT, just tell us what we have to do.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
If we have to run this little five, that is so, so good. And frankly, that's what gives me hope, not only in the sport of ultra running, but in the world. Like when that happens, when you got an hour left to get from here to there, you're going to figure out a way to do it. And you know what? If you end up not doing it, you're going to figure out a way to maybe do it next year or in some other race. That's just beautiful.
And you trust yourself as a team. You work together. You hand over the logistics to someone else and you trust them. You know, you watch the marker. Did you see the marker? Saw the marker? Good. We're good. And all of a sudden, what are race competitors, and we're really not, but defined, you know, Webster Dictionary calls us competitors because we have bibs on. No, we're teammates and we're colleagues and we're friends and we get things done together. It's to your words there, AJW, it's the human spirit coming together and becoming stronger. Really, the beauty of the sport lies in us all working together.
Hey, Don, I want to remind you of a story that I think relates well to this topic on how you can do the math, and doing the math helps eliminate the worry and the stress and the anxiety. And that was a couple years ago at the Moab 240, where you sent me a video of you sitting on the side of the trail at halfway, mile 140 or so?
I was at 140 and I was spent. I was done and I'd thrown in the white flag. I was taking a video so I could watch myself later validate how miserable I was. And it was a personal moment. And I sent it over to you. The next thing I know, it was on YouTube. But that's what friends do. And I'm okay with that. But I had called Bob right after my personal video. And I said, hey, Bob, I'm in a spot that I can't get out of. And he said, well, you're not that bad. Let me do some math for you. And he laid it out and created a strategy that was a run walk. I didn't have to travel too fast and I could get it done. And it made the biggest difference. It removed the worry. I handed the math over. I handed the plan over and it executed and it worked. He gave me hope. And I came across another runner and I said, hey, other runner, I just talked to the smartest guy I know with numbers. And he said, we've got this. Here's the plan. And we shared the plan and we finished the run together. Well, not the whole run together, but we both made it to the finish line based on a plan and had hope. So getting rid of the worry, getting rid of the math, finding a strategy, and then just trusting it was the real key.
Yeah, took the worry out of it, took that monkey off your back and gave you hope. I love that story. And the video is amazing too. Again, I'll link that in the show notes.
Thanks, pal.
Hey, good collaboration on good list here, Don Freeman, the Simple Seven.
That's good. You should print those out in on show notes, Scott. I think that would be good. We'll put the seven right there.
What do you think I do? What do you think I do with the show notes?
I've never seen the show notes. Where do you get them?
I'll send you a screenshot.
Thanks. AJW, I mean, quite honestly, have you seen the show notes before? Or are they're just a legend that they don't exist? What do you think?
Well, I think it's fun to talk about the show notes.
Yeah.
Hey, of the three people that read the show notes, they've all thanked me. I've had 100% of the people that look at them thank me for the show notes. I spent a lot of time on it. I'm a busy man, Don.
I know you are. I know you are, Scott. I know you are. All right. Well, thank you, guys. I think we should. I think you know, I'm always looking, and I think we are always looking for, you know, a series. I think this Simple Seven would go well in nutrition, Simple Seven of rehab, Simple Seven of a lot of things. I think we could find a lot of experts that could come on and fill those things. And I'm not saying we could do it, but I think we could bring somebody on and help define the Simple Seven.
And there are a lot of listeners out there that may have their own Simple Seven. Mm. We would love to hear from you. Leave it in the comments.
We have comments.
Jeez, Freeman, get on board. Hey, Andy, thanks for joining us. It's good to see you. I've been following your Strava account and you're putting in some good miles out there.
I'm doing my best. I'm going to do another 100 miler in October. So I have to keep running. I guess the last thing I'd like to say is that, one of the things that I really like about what Don put together with the Simple Seven is, you know, for the last 2 years now, there's been a fair bit of anxiety, like in the world, anxiety and in the running world, in the world, whatever. And what a lot of these rules tell me is that, you know, there are ways to kind of get through it. And for me, as I think anybody listening to this podcast knows, that it's you get through it, but in any means that you can. For me, it's having a disciplined approach to my training and running. And even though I'm slower and older, and, you know, I'm going to go out to Javelina 100 and just hope to break 24 hours and then accept that that what happens, happens. So it's like, if you can take your anxiety and turn it into discipline and then ultimately acceptance, then it's a good thing. And I think that's a little bit about what the simple rules are about. So I love this idea. I love the idea of a series. And I mean, Trail Runner Nation, it's been a long slog these last couple of years. We're coming out the other side, but man, thank you guys. Thanks for having the podcast and thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for coming on. And I think none of these rules are really new, and most of us could have written them down, but it's fun to talk about them and it's fun to kind of throw stories around with them. And we didn't invent the rules. We just worked through them and learned them the hard way like the rest of us did. So we're just speaking our common trail language here on this podcast.
Andy, we'll also, of course, link it in the show notes, but you're still doing some coaching. You have some slots?
I am. I have right now just two. AJW. Two open slots at AJW at trainwright.com. Just if someone's interested in coaching, let me know.
And if you could find it in the show notes, I'll pay for your tuition or whatever you call it there to get in. Because I don't even think the show notes exist, Scott. I'll buy that round, whatever that's called, AJW. What do you call your fee for service? Like buying a round at the tap room?
I'll definitely take a round.
So go out and run.
Mas.
Hey, Scott, a trail race doesn't happen on its own, and a podcast doesn't happen on its own either.
No, we need to thank all those that provide and help us produce this good content. We want to thank the Patreon supporters. We really appreciate your contributions, the small aid that you make every month to help us improve on what we're trying to do here. We want to thank our producer, Doug Mayer, who is enjoying UTMB in the heart of Chamonix this week.
We'd also like to thank sound man Ryan, who's with every episode and making sure that we're keeping on course.
And editing all of the bad stuff out, keeping the good stuff in. He's turning really all of our 3-hour podcasts into less than an hour podcast. That's 2/3 of the crap we say gets edited out.
We'd like to thank Doug Crumley, who is going to be running his first 100-mile run coming up. He's a business-level Patreon member.
And a new addition is Yana Gibalova, who is our social media czar. You may be seeing some really cool social media content coming out, and she's responsible for that. Don and I don't even know how to log into those social media accounts, much less provide good content. And she's there to help us out. She's an active trail runner also, and we're glad that she's on board.